Three Points of No Return, Glimpses of the Future. In most ages of the world's history, people have believed that they were living in a special time, a time of upheaval and change, especially when the turn of a century or a new millennium approached. In most cases, this was an optical illusion arising from an overrated view of their respective present times, a kind of here and now chauvinism. Sometimes they were fooled by chronology and made the naive assumption that God, when he let the last trump sound, would stick to our decimal system and thus have a preference for round figures. As we approach the year 2000, however, three points are indicated, which seem to be true points of no return, quite apart from any chauvinism for the present age. Point of no return is an expression used by airline pilots. It indicates the place on a runway beyond which there are only two alternatives, liftoff or crash. It is no longer possible to put on the brakes. I believe I can make out three such points. The first and most serious for life on Earth is the end of natural evolution. The second, less crucial but decisive for the future of the human race, is the expiration of the time period within the Homo sapiens can manage to become a species able to travel in space. The third point, though it is least important in universal terms, is relevant for world peace and thus for our immediate survival, as well as being a close personal experience for millions of Europeans. I mean the collapse of the existing socialist governments. After more than 40 years of ideological paralysis, there are developments in the political landscape. We are full of hope for the new cause that has been planned, but no one knows where it will lead. Let us glance at these three points of no return, which make their own varied but distinct impacts on the history of the Earth. First point, evolution. Neither the New Wave nor the finest individual books of science fiction have managed to capture the interest of the media or of the literary and cultural establishment, at least not in Germany. Stand on Zanzibar is granted as little recognition as The Dispossessed. Dune is not noticed, and neither is the Foundation Trilogy, at least not in Germany. They are all lumped together and degraded as pulp and dismissed without a word. In the last 2 years, however, strange to say, a change has crept in. Cyberpunk has made it. Cyberpunk is the mega hit. I'm not saying that this has made science fiction respectable at one blow, that the barriers of the ghetto have fallen like the Berlin Wall. No, science fiction still has to defend itself as much as ever against lack of understanding and prejudice. But with cyberpunk, for the first time, science fiction has managed to exert an unexpectedly wide influence beyond its traditional limits. This keen interest was shown not only by readers, but by the media and without any special publicity. How could this happen? The novels of Gibson, Kedray, Rucker, Shiner, Shirley, Sterling, Swanwick, and Williams aroused only a moderate interest among SF readers in Germany. The traditional science fiction public, especially the hardliners, who grew up with their Heinlein, Asimov, and Clarke, did not understand or accept these books. Sometimes they hated them. Was this something to do with the translations? Not at all. Cyberpunk is extremely difficult to translate. I was aware of this because I knew and valued the stories of the cyberpunk authors from the beginning and gave the translation of their books to my best translators. I also feel that the traditional science fiction readers are still under the lying spell of the Gernsback continuum, the beautiful illusion of a perfect world of tomorrow, last refugee of the utopian ideas of the day before yesterday. This is the dream of the spotless arcs up there in orbit, at the Lagrange points and further out, filled with clean air, pure water, and human beings with pure hearts. This is the step into space, a new beginning. Meanwhile, down below, a rundown Earth suffocates under a flood of human beings and decays in its own filth, simmering away towards its doom under a layer of carbon dioxide, while the ozone gap grows wider and wider. Readers who dream of a beautiful elitist future based on the glossy brochures from NASA or ESA, and always a bit fascistoid, it seems to me, must find it disgusting and nasty when Michael Swanwick, for instance, in Vacuum Flowers describes habitats quite differently. We hear of the filthy slums proliferating in their weightless zones, inhabited by a riff-raff of doubtful genetic origin, teeming with life and bringing with it all the stink and chemicals of this anarchistic excess of life. I find these anarchistic visions fascinating, bizarre and exotic, whether they ever come into being or not. I think conditions like these are more likely and more human than a perfect spotless utopia. When man leaves the earth, he will take his world with him, just as it is, just as the animals who once moved on the dry land took the ocean with them. To this day, the salt content of our blood is that of seawater. But where does this enthusiasm for cyberpunk come from? Does it come, strangely enough, from outside the traditional science fiction readership? Cyberpunk has opened a new area of space, the space behind the monitor screen. It promises the imagination new game variations. It gives the feeling of omniscience, of being everywhere at once. It promises, above all, a new form of existence, loosed from the bonds of the physical body with all its biological limitation and its vulnerability. Here we have uncanny new territory and a bundle of fascinating effects which capture the imagination of all those who, sitting before a screen, suddenly become aware of the possibility of transcendence in the software. All this has certainly contributed to the popularity of cyberpunk, but this alone is not enough to arouse the interest of those who usually take no notice of science fiction. I believe cyberpunk has touched upon something, merely scratched the surface of the subject, not plumbed its depths, which I regard as a point of no return in human evolution, in the evolution of life on Earth. It is the end of the trial and error method, steered by chance in the area of genetics, the making of designer creations, whether vegetable or animal or a mixture of both, as well as a made-to-measure persons, long foreseen by Huxley in Brave New World, has now become possible. Laws will keep high-handed gene manipulation within bounds, at least for a time, but the technique will not be halted. The possibility of specific alterations is too much of a challenge for the scientists. The seduction of the possible is too great, and what is possible is not only interesting, but on top of that, it is financially rewarding. The opening of this wide and dangerous field of research and application fills everyone who knows the risks with a mixture of fascination and dread. It would be going too far at this moment to follow up individual dangers. There are made scenarios in science fiction of industrial accidents which changed the world, from Peddler Davis' Mutant 59, The Plastic Eater, to Greg Bear's Blood Music. Other problems just as relevant has been announced here and there. The standardized genome deluxe, selection at a molecular level, a molecular Auschwitz, a sort of genetic golden credit card for the higher echelons in management and politics? Discrimination against those elite by the genetically inferior, and the problem of data protection in this intimate sphere. Then there is a clone, it's a clone as a spare part store for accidents victims and a source of all organ replacements for the geriatric department. The possibility of destructively high expectations from cloned people whose rights to their own biography would be denied. In short, the power of the dead over the living. The attempt by the parent generation to decide the fate of its posterity. The result will not be children of thunder who punch their parents in the face for this genetic interference, but terribly healthy, terribly conformist, terribly boring creatures like those in Huxley's horrific vision. What cyberpunk has made clear is the weird, frightened, but morbidly exciting possibility that our species has reached a point where it gives up the picture of itself, its own self-image. The picture of mankind, made by God in his own image, as some believe, is ready to dissolve. Greg Bear tried to make this clear to his public in a scene described by Norman Spinrad. How many of you think people will look recognizable human 50 years from now, he asked. A forest of hands. You are all wrong, Bear declared with his usual calm geniality. And in another place, David Brin used it as the motto of one of the chapters in The Uplift War. Natural selection won't matter soon, not anywhere near as much as conscious selection. We will civilize and alter ourselves to suit our ideas of what we can be. Within one more human lifespan, we will have changed ourselves unrecognizably. Within a few generations, different species could have developed from the genus Homo, species which differ widely from each other, as Bruce Sterling shows in his Shaper Mechanist stories. Spinrad writes of Sterling, evolution, she Sterling, moves in clades or to daughter species. It does not move linearly, it radiates. Successful species do not evolve in a straight line into a single daughter species, they radiate into a multitude of successor species. The human race will gradually alter its appearance, but not over a period of millions or billions of years, as Stapleton described it in Last and First Men. Within decades, it could be the case that when we communicate with an intelligence which we cannot see, we will not be able to say with certainty whether we are dealing with a human being on the good old-fashioned flesh, with a hybrid of human genes, the genes of other animals and vegetable genes, a construct of biological, mechanical, and electronic elements, with a Turing machine, or with a human consciousness wafting through cyberspace as software. Reality could soon look much more exotic and baroque than all that the science fiction authors have thought up in this century. But if we believe William Gibson, and we have no reason not to, reality has very little meaning for those who go into the interface. Gibson's virtual reality opens up a boundless cosmos of possible experiences. It promises the sensation of countless parallel realities. A human being can enter into these realities at will, and they are no longer experienced assimilation. They are surrogates, worlds without number, giving promise of the thrill of many lives, yes, even a promise of eternal life in the transcendence of cyberspace. That is the fascination of cyberpunk, and it is difficult not to fall under its spell. Many readers, for whom science fiction otherwise meant little, have made this discovery. Second point, space-traveling species. The second point has much more to do with reality and with life in our very own reality, which, in spite of every advance in science and technology, is becoming more desolate and wretched every day. Confronted by the need and the poverty in the third world, more and more people, mainly conservationists, but also an increasing number of politicians, journalists, and even scientists from other disciplines, of course, find that activities in space, especially manned missions, are a luxury that the industrial nations cannot invest in, which are a clear conscience. These critics see doubtful prestige enterprises swallow up immense sums which would be better employed in feeding Earth's hungry masses. Billions of dollars are spent to help a chosen few on a spacewalk or to obtain a few kilos of stone from the moon or from Mars, while daily in the third world 40,000 people, mainly children, die of hunger, and daily hundreds of thousands suffer irreparable brain damage through lack of protein. The supporters of the space program, cornered in this way, usually fall back on the legendary Teflon pan and other high-tech spin-offs. They point to worldwide communication by satellite and the Earth watch, which can find new resources, predict hurricanes, and document the death of the forests, the ozone gap, and other destructive effects of technology on the environment. In fact, space travel costs only a tiny fraction of the money spent throughout the world every year on armaments and defense. Carl Sagan, for example, informs us, using a report of the government's General Accounting Office, the New York Times, July 19, 1970, we learned that the total anticipated cost of a Viking mission to land on Mars in 76 is about half that of the cost overruns in the so-called Safeguard anti-ballistic missile system for fiscal year 70. The cost of a grand tour exploration for all the planets in the outer solar system, cancelled for lack of funds, is comparable to the 70 cost overruns on the Minuteman III system, the cost of a very large optical telescope in space capable of definitive studies of the origins of the universe is comparable to the 1970 cost overruns of the Minuteman II missile. And a major program of Earth resources satellites involving several years of close inspection of the surface and weather of our planet would cost approximately the fiscal year 1970 cost overruns of the P-3C aircraft. A decade-long program of systematic investigation of the entire solar system would cost as much as the accounting mistakes on a single defense weapon system in a single year. The scientific space program is small change compared to the errors in the Department of Defense budget. These arguments may all be correct, but there are two further arguments in favor of the space program which are often overlooked and seldom brought into the discussion. In these arguments, space travel is regarded as indispensable for the future of mankind. As one might expect, we are dealing here with space travel in two of its long-term aspects. The usual thinking of our day in fiscal years and legislative periods makes it easy to lose sight of the developments which take place over hundreds or even thousands of years, spanning generations. Jesko von Puttkamer, a German member of NASA, calls this phenomenon generation chauvinism. We are talking about the supply of energy and the cosmological aspect of an advancing evolution. Take the energy problem. Its solution is no longer science fiction, but a bitter necessity. Generation chauvinism is holding up this solution, although it deals with the survival of many billions of human beings in heavily endangered areas. We are wasting every day more fossil fuel than the Earth could store up in 1,000 years. In a mere 200 years of industrial age, We have managed to use up almost all the reserves of energy, which collected over hundreds of millions of years in the form of mineral oil, natural gas, and coal. We burn 9 to 10 billion tons of oil per year. For an expert estimate, I am relying here on the study of Reinhard Dahlberg, a former director of the giant AEG electrical concern, which with the title The Advanced Technical Use of the Sun, and on an interview with him broadcast by Bavarian Radio on the 11th of January 1990. According to Dahlberg, oil resources will be exhausted in about 2040. At a seminar at the University of Bahrain of Saudi Arabian member remarked cynically on the subject, "The oil will last us for 600 years. You," meaning the industrial states, "can do what you want." This gives us an idea of what could develop in this sensitive region. Embittered fighting over the last of the oil. So what about atomic power? In order to close the energy gap until the year 2040, we would need 60,000 atomic power plants worldwide. Every year, 1,200 new reactors would have to be taken into the network. A really crazy idea. Nuclear reactors can't be set up in the desert. They need water for cooling purposes. And this usually means location in thickly populated, fertile regions. This means reactors within a stone's throw of each other, rivers seething with hot waste, even more concrete, even heavier security, even more atomic waste and storage problems. And every year, somewhere or other, a Chernobyl or something worse. Dahlberg's study suggested the large-scale build-up of hydrogen and energy. Sunlight should be turned into electric power on great energy plantations. This power could then be used to divide water into hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen would then be piped into industrial areas. This would mean that the European community must lease large areas in the Sahara. The energy required by the West German states alone and obtained today from oil would require 100 of these energy plantations, each one 5 square kilometers. It will cost 400 billion marks to install these facilities. The project has, in fact, a number of grave disadvantages. Even in the northern Sahara, which has one of the highest radiation quotas of sunlight, the conditions are not ideal. Even at its zenith, the sun does not stand directly overhead. Considerably sunlight is lost passing through Earth's atmosphere, and at night, absolutely no energy is collected. The plant would be exposed to wind and weather and would have to be regularly freed of sand and dust. Pipelines filled with hydrogen are highly explosive. Terrorists and the military would be continually rise to the occasion. The climatic results are not quite clear. Hundreds of square kilometers of the desert floor would no longer be warmed by the sun. How much simpler it would be to move this energy project or part of it into space. The sun radiation would be optimal at all times. The antennae could be directed at the sun and would be bathed in its unshadowed energy-rich light. The gain in photovoltaic electric power would be many times that obtainable on Earth. Already in the middle of the 60s, the American physicist Peter E. Glaser made a study of project for collecting solar energy in space for NASA. They were all labeled unprofitable and set aside. 6 years ago, space travel specialists from MBB, Messerschmitt-Birkhoff-Blohm, were very skeptical about the realization of such projects. But just lately, a scenario from MBB published in the magazine Luft und Raumfahrt, February 1989, was entitled Unlimited clean energy from space, a global energy concept for the 21st century. There has in fact been a decisive breakthrough recently in photovoltaics. This is amorphic silicon technology. The tiny blocks of silicon carbide no longer have to be cut like diamond in the making of collector cells. The non-crystalline silicon carbide is now steamed on the gossamer thin sheets of foil. This process brings a decided reduction in weight and volume for transport into space. These sun sails unfold themselves as the collector satellite revolves in space. The power plants would be mounted in a lower Earth orbit, start production and use their first sun energy to move in the geostationary orbit with help from their ion drives. They would drop anchor between the communication satellites and regularly send the energy gains to receiving stations on the Earth's surface in the form of laser-steered bundles of microwave impulses. This is the only reasonable energy concept anywhere inside, which can protect the Earth from a climatic disaster and also retain technological civilization. Of course, the necessary investment are gigantic, but they are indispensable. Evolution, life on Earth in the form of human beings and in the form of the high technology has reached a critical phase. This is truly a point of no return. We are coming to the end of the runway. We must lift off now, at any price. We must become astronauts. So now we come to the cosmological aspects of advanced evolution. Are we alone in the cosmos? Is it possible that under different suns life has developed in suitable planets and that this development has reached the level of thinking intelligent beings? The notion that this could only be the case on Earth is against all probability, and it sounds too much like the old anthropocentric vanity. Man and his world as the center of the universe. Hypotheses about extraterrestrial civilizations are a bit of a guessing game. Carl Sagan, the American astronomer I have already quoted, estimates that in our own Milky Way alone, there are 1 million technical civilizations. In this essay collection, Broca's Brain, published in German as Aufbruch in den Kosmos, he writes, 1 million civilizations is a breathtakingly large number, and it is exhilarating to imagine the diversity, lifestyles, and commerce of those 1 million worlds. But the Milky Way galaxy contains some 250 billion stars, and even with 1 million civilizations, less than one star in 200,000 would have a planet inhabited by an advanced civilization. Since we have little idea which stars are likely candidates, we will have to examine a very large number of them. Such considerations suggest that the quest of extraterrestrial intelligence may require a significant effort. In the 60s and 70s, the SETI, Search of Extraterrestrial Intelligence projects, were set up to listen for the signs of extraterrestrial civilizations. In the 90s, a wider search is planned with better instruments and highly ingenious computer support. These are the multi-channel spectral analyzers, which are able to listen to 14 million frequencies at the same time. Between 1992 and 1999, $100 million will be available for this great bugging action with the name SETI Microwave Observing Project. Following a general look around as phase one, the second phase will be a search action aimed at 773 stars resembling the sun up to a distance of 82 light years. Perhaps this time we will succeed in finding somewhere in the depths of space that electronic debris with which every technological civilization surrounds itself, like a cloud spreading out of the speed of, at the speed of light. It seems to be simply a question of time until we find a radio source of this kind, or until we are found by one. By now, the ceaseless electronic chatter of the human race, spread out to the distance of 100 light years, has already filled a tiny corner of the galaxy. In fact, 1/500th part. And at these vast distances, contact is a question of centuries, and dialogue a matter of thousands of years. Only then will we receive further information on fundamental questions concerning the development of life, the universe, and everything, and, especially, information on the patterns of development of other high-tech civilizations. It is certain that evolution still has a few untried security mechanisms. Before an intelligent race becomes a space-traveling species, it must meet several requirements before being admitted to the astronauts club. One trap that an intelligent race can fall into, if it is not clever enough, is the deadly trap of self-destruction, whether by nuclear holocaust or the plagues resulting from careless gene manipulation. A second trap, which is not deadly at once, but which can rob a civilization of its future, is the failure to cope with energy problems. This is a further danger for a civilization that is clever, but not clever enough. An advanced civilization can develop on the basis of fossil fuel resources, but it must have taken the step into space before these resources are used up. They are simply the provision for the great journey. When these resources are used up too soon, a civilized race has disqualified itself. It is shut out from the community of developing intelligent life forms in the universe. There is no second chance. If some descendants of mankind or some other intelligent terrestrial life form builds up a new high culture in the distant future, it will not be a technical civilization, because the necessary resources of fossil fuels are no longer available. These beings of the far future will not reach space. The possibility of being astronauts is given only once per planet. The requirements for the evolution of a space-traveling intelligence are very strict. Mankind may fail to take this crucial step. Although a worthwhile energy program is one of our highest priorities, the realization of any such program becomes more and more difficult from year to year. The Earth's immense problems, the alterations of the climate, and the famine this brings with it are becoming acute. There's nothing wrong with saving energy, with using insulation, with wind power, or with sun cells on the roof. But anyone who thinks these measures will save the situation is a dreamer who has no grasp of the immensity of the problem. In order to keep a world population of 6 billion from starvation, in order to provide sufficient transport and to supply and clean the vast overcrowded living quarters, for these purposes we need energy supplies of the order of the 10 million tons of oil per year that we have already mentioned, or its equivalent. And in 50 years that oil will no longer be available. The importation of this clean energy from space, where it is in practically unlimited supply, is a necessary step for mankind. The same goes for minerals from the moon and the asteroid belt. The alternatives are depressing. After all fossil fuels are burned, the Earth will be shrouded in a murky haze of carbon dioxide and methane. The greenhouse effect will take over, growing stronger through feedback. The melting of the permafrost regions will free vast masses of methane products into the atmosphere, while dying masses of organic matter will pump in more and more carbon dioxide. In these circumstances, an increase in the mean temperature of 0.55 degrees Celsius per decade will push the climatic zones 50 to 80 kilometers north every 10 years. But the mean temperature, as we pointed out, keeps on rising. Natural vegetation cannot escape the heat. A forest can move forward no faster than 800 meters a year when the climate changes. The forests would be caught by the heat. They would die and set free even more carbon dioxide. Already in the early years of the 21st century, the burned-out desert regions could reach from the Congo to the Alps, and the highest temperatures in Central Europe could rise to 50 or 60 degrees Celsius, that is 120 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. The air masses heated over these vast desert regions and the heavier evaporation of the seawater would lead to a stronger rotation of the atmosphere layers, with wind velocities higher than ever before upon Earth. A tiny foretaste of these were the hurricanes in Europe at the beginning of this year. As the vegetation failed, more and more land would be lost for agriculture. Dreadful weather conditions, storms and floods would damage or destroy harvests on land that was already encroached upon the rising seas following the melting of the polar ice caps. These scenarios are not science fiction, I am sorry to say. These come from a computer simulation done by James Hansen and his colleagues from the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in Manhattan. Under these conditions, great famines would reduce the population to a billion or fewer. Mankind would have to sink to a lower pre-technological level of civilization, perhaps into a state of barbarism in which every man's hand is raising against every other. Everything points to a long, unpleasant afternoon of the human race, unless it wakes up at 5 to 12, that is right now, if it is not already too late, seizes its chance and takes the great step into space and into the future. Third point, parallel worlds. Who foresaw the political change that has taken place in Europe? Was it prophesied in science fiction? No. That is not a science fiction's job. Science fiction is not illustrated futurology or calculated probabilities. It is a game of possibilities. Just the same science fiction has been hard hit by the present political experiences. Dozens of novels that could have been regarded 2 or 3 years ago as probable perspectives have had to be turned into novels of alternate worlds. If a novel had been offered me a year ago, which included in its plot the fall of the Berlin Wall, free travel between East and West, and Václav Havel as president of Czechoslovakia, I would have regarded the author as an innocent dreamer, a hopeless crackpot without any regard of logic and orderly political development. The manuscript would have been rejected out of hand as a piece of utopian preaching. Of course, the futurologists themselves have all failed to predict the future, and we are caught up in the tide of events. And, who'd have thought it? So were the astrologers. Not one of them foresaw what would happen. On the contrary, many prophesied a military engagement between East and West. So the impossible has happened, something that was not even within the bounds of possibility. Applied socialism, socialist governments no longer exist. There are a few exceptions, but even they show signs of disillusion. True socialism has, in fact, not existed since Stalin's time. Powerful politicians were in control. They accepted only those thinkers who praised their reigns of terror and backed them up theoretically. All those who thought differently were pushed aside, outlawed, and liquidated. Frank Herbert never tired to quoting Lord Acton, the British historian, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." The ruling cliques in the so-called communist countries became over the years totally corrupt and decayed politically, morally, and economically. A totalitarian bureaucracy had arisen that was bound to collapse under the weight of its own alienation from actual conditions. All it needed was one push, and this was given by the leadership of the Soviet Union. When Gorbachev took over the government, he read the signs of the times correctly. He saw that things couldn't go no further, and he undertook what Germans call eine Flucht nach vorn. He leapt ahead of the approaching disaster in order to save what could be saved. Does this mean that capitalism has won? One of our more conservative parties, the Christian Social Union in Bavaria, thinks so and is celebrating with mottos like socialism nevermore. The CSU election posters show Karl Marx as a failed philosopher who should apologize to the proletarians of all nations. This is the kind of ignorant and tasteless stuff we get from conservative right-wing dinosaurs and their profit-hungry fellow travelers, the yuppies. These people cannot wait to move into the former socialist countries, introduce the hard sell society, and fleece the suckers in the name of free enterprise, as if the poor Easterners had any chance in this unequal market. These profiteers and carpetbaggers show an insatiable lust for profit and for so-called progress at any price. They see the future only as an increase of interest on the interest rates. They spare no thoughts for the future of mankind, only of their own. I believe these people are celebrating too early. This is typically short-sighted. They think only in fiscal years and legislative periods. They are not able to think of long-term effects or to think and act in the interest of the community, let alone that of mankind. They are unable to recognize the fact that reckless capitalism inevitably kindles the fire of new socialist ideas. It is high time that the hoary old Eastern bureaucracy was swept on the rubbish tip of history. The socialist ideal has been insulted and injured by its example for decades. But this socialist ideal appealed to intellectuals throughout the world. Most of them turned aside from the applied socialism of the communist governments because they were disgusted by Stalinistic practices. Think of George Orwell or Arthur Koestler. In East Germany, the time of fast money is about to break out. A time to fill one's pockets and push the weaker to the wall. East Germany looks like an Eldorado for unification profiteers and loan sharks. The legal position is uncertain, the citizens are inexperienced in commercial affairs and frightened to the sudden changes. It is hard to shake off the fear of the bureaucracy and of the party bosses instilled into the population by years of state oppression. But these times will pass. The left-wing parties of Europe, under sharp attack from the right, will regain the footing in the European community, together with the trade unions. Now there is a real chance to develop a socialist system of government, a socialist position somewhere between the Scandinavian model and the Eurocommunism of Italy. Is this a utopia from the day before yesterday? No. I believe it is a timeless and human idea. Men will continue to live and strive for the realization of this idea against all opposition and in spite of all historical perversions. In the same way, the ideals of Christianity will always be part of human aspiration in spite of the paralyzing influence of the churches. An historic moment has been reached. Things are moving politically from the Baltics to South Africa, from Korea to Chile. We must not miss the chance to create a just society in which every human being can live in peace and have the opportunity for a worthwhile existence. Without this liberty and justice for all, our species has no future. Mankind has learned to be afraid of atomic weapons. We have lived on the edge of nuclear holocaust for too long. Talking of possible fears, I have finally to ask you all, please keep an eye on my country. You science fiction readers, more than other people, are accustomed to read what-if scenarios, to think in alternatives and look at certain developments from another perspective. A united Germany, what could it be like? All of us who know the Germans believe that a new economic miracle is on the way. It has already been programmed by the proverbial German efficiency. When modern industrial installations have risen from the ruins of the GDR, Germany could become a disproportionately strong economic power in the European community and tomorrow possibly in the world. This will cause envy and ill will. We have already heard the first reactions not only from Rome and London, and we have heard the Germans' touchy reaction to this criticism. Germany could be forced into isolation by these unfriendly reactions on both sides. An explosive mixture of wounded national vanity, stubbornness, and arrogance could grow, poisoning the international atmosphere as it did between the two world wars, when it finally led to a terrible conflict. Hundreds and thousands of Americans, English, French, Dutch, Belgians, Russians, Poles, Czechs, Slovaks, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and others gave their lives to overcome the evil spirit of National Socialism and send it back into hell. These brave men of many nations saved us all from a parallel world of unspeakable horror, fear, and bestiality, which would have meant to end the human reason and human civilization. The Nazis began their grisly work in Auschwitz and Treblinka and, at the last, were considering the systematic destruction of the entire non-Aryan population of the world. There were actual plans for this. The next step following the destruction of the Jews was to be the destruction of African Negroes. We all hope devoutly that the Nazis met their point of no return in 1945, but there is no guarantee of that. Those soldiers from all nations, your fathers and grandfathers, must not have died in vain, but the evil spirit of Nazism that they defeated is not dead. It is lurking about, ready to grasp power again. The specters of intolerance, hostility to strangers, xenophobia, are haunting the whole of Europe, not only Germany. The Germans can become dangerous, however, because of their dreadful efficiency. Germans are not so very proud of being German. They have guilt feelings, however, much of these are repressed. But Germans are proud of their efficiency. They are of the opinion that if everyone else were half as efficient and diligent as they are, and would get to work properly instead of loafing, then there would be no more hunger or poverty in the world. In fact, the world would look like Germany, West Germany of course, clean, neat and orderly. This is a horror vision, of course, and somehow the German recognizes this too, so he gets into his Mercedes and drives away on holiday in other lands where things are more relaxed. He is not very pleased to hear that his efficiency contributes to the death of the forests, pollutes the rivers, contaminates the air, and makes the quality of the groundwater deteriorate every year, because efficiency should give him that special feeling of superiority. The Japanese are a thorn in his flesh. He cannot forgive his former allies, not only for finding out how the German makes good cameras and radios, but especially for being so devilishly efficient that they can make better cameras and radios. I am talking here about a truly dreadful German efficiency, with overtones of diligence and thoroughness. Claude Lanzmann, his film Shoah, gives a ghastly example. In the course of the final solution of the Jewish question, concentration camp inmates were loaded into closed trucks under pretext of a journey to another camp. Actually, they were driven around in the district while poison gas was pumped into the truck, and the journey ended at the crematorium, where the bodies were unloaded and the vehicle prepared for the next trip. In order to increase the transport capacity, experiments were made with a larger freight compartment on the same chassis. Experts were afraid that extra passengers would cause a strain on the front axle, but a construction engineer dispelled their doubts. His argument was as follows. When the truck drove off and gas began to stream in, the prisoners would instinctively rush to the locked back doors trying to escape, and the front axle would not be overloaded at all. It would need no reinforcement. This is the kind of thing that impresses me as a dreadful efficiency. Ice-cold technical efficiency, completely inhuman and completely immoral. I am sorry to say that this kind of efficiency is still to be found in German right up to the present day. Whether it is submarines for South Africa, technical equipment for chemical weapons for Libya, biological equipment for B weapons for Baghdad, or the equipment of nuclear technology in Pakistan. German efficiency in these fields is a demand by the military throughout the world, the efficient death made in Germany. So those old spectres of discrimination and the hatred of foreigners will rise again as more people come from the East and from the Third World. Loud talk and threats will be heard through the beer fumes when the regulars meet at the pub. And we have never been short of political demagogues. So I ask you again, keep an eye on Germany. To come to an end, the high priests and critics of the literary establishment have always accused science fiction of paying too little attention of characterization. Science fiction writers, they say, are satisfied with stereotypes. Science fiction writers can lack talent in this direction. On the other hand, this accusation has something to do with the narrow perspective of established mainstream literature. It is a young literature, as Dorrie Lessing pointed out at the Worldcon in Brighton in 1987. The novel arose in the 18th century and has experienced its greatness flowering during the 19th and early 20th century. The art of the novel reflects the spirit of the great middle class, the prosperous bourgeoisie. The novel's great subject is the individual, his character, his inner and outer development, his relation to society, his personal relationships, above all, his success or his tragic failure. The novel has individual persons as its theme, sometimes a family, the way they stay together or are torn apart, their ability to battle through, their way to fortune and wisdom. The romance is thousands of years older than the novel. In the romance, individual persons are not heavily characterized. The protagonists are not so much individuals as identifiable types, heroes, chieftains, leaders, adventurers. The romances tell of the hero's destiny and of the destiny of the clan, the tribe, the race. Science fiction stands in this older tradition. It tells the story of the human species, how it could be and how it should not be. From its narrow ecocentric viewpoint, bourgeois literature is not ready, or perhaps not able, to recognize points of no return, to examine them closely and to face the consequences. This lack of vision in established literature makes science fiction possible and necessary. This is the job of science fiction authors, to present the possible futures opening up before us, however unthinkable or unimaginable they may be, to fill these futures with life and make them plausible. The science fiction author must give these futures an emotional component that touches us all as readers, not simply to entertain us, but to open our eyes to new historical perspectives reaching far beyond the horizons of our daily lives, where most of our contemporaries plot on their Ptolemaic round. I have always been frustrated and disturbed by the narrow perspectives of establishment literature, its here and now chauvinism, the pleasure it takes in regarding its own image. I hate the way in which it clings to a bourgeois notion of reality, in which nothing fantastic is permitted except perhaps in dreams. I hate the unnatural, noisy talk, the jangling voices, much ado about nothing but a few characters who mostly interest no one but the author himself. The fascination of science fiction for me was always the breadth of its vision, which brought into view new experiences affecting the destiny of our species, the vision of these points of no return. Thank you.